There's this illusion we all kind of buy into when it comes to financial markets. It's this expectation of just like absolute surgical precision. Like if you're a retail investor, you open an app on your phone, you tap buy, the screen flashes green, and boom, you own the stock.
Right. It feels like gravity or something. The money leaves, the shares appear, and you never really think twice about the actual mechanics making it happen.
Exactly. But that pristine digital machine is really just a user interface.
Yeah.
When you step behind the curtain into the actual world of broker-to-broker clearance and settlement, that clean aesthetic just completely vanishes.
Oh, yeah, it's gone.
It stops looking like a supercomputer and it starts looking like this chaotic, high-stakes bazaar, basically. We're talking about an operational landscape governed by counterparty risk, delivery failures, physical pieces of paper getting chewed up by dogs and ticking legal clocks.
Yeah, it's the plumbing. It is the plumbing of the global financial system. And like any plumbing, when it works, nobody notices it. But when it backs up, the mess is just catastrophic.
Yeah.
Behind every simple stock purchase is this massive, complex architecture designed entirely to prevent the whole system from collapsing when someone inevitably, makes a mistake.
Right. And that plumbing is exactly what we are wading into today,
Yeah.
which is highly relevant because understanding this machinery is the core of function four on the Series Come Four exam. And by the way, if you're currently grinding through your Series 24 prep, this deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel. They actually built a full Series 24 course with like adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real test. And what I really appreciate about it is the adaptive part. It figures out what concepts you're struggling with and, forces you to confront them so you don't just blank on exam day. You can check that out at certfuel.com.
Yeah, it's an incredible resource for exactly this kind of material because honestly, this is the stuff that trips people up.
It really is. So let's talk about how we're going to tackle this.
Yeah.
For anyone studying out there, we are not going to just read you a list of regulatory deadlines.
Right, please no.
Rote memorization is a terrible way to learn, and frankly, won't save you when the exam throws some twisted, convoluted fact pattern your way. We need to understand the underlying logic. So we're going to break down the Uniform Practice Code, or the UPC. If you understand why these specific settlement rules exist, the right answer will usually just like reveal itself through common sense.
That is the perfect approach. I mean, the UPC wasn't written just to be annoying. It was written in response to real-world crises, mostly brokers basically blowing each other up by failing to deliver securities.
Right. And to keep us grounded in that reality, we're going to follow a recurring cast of characters today. These are the people creating and solving these crises. So first, we have Failing Frank. Yeah. Frank is a broker-dealer who means well. But his back office is an absolute disaster. He still uses fax machines, he forgets deadlines, and he constantly fails to deliver securities on time.
Yeah, every major clearing firm has dealt with a failing Frank. I mean, he is the walking embodiment of systemic risk.
Exactly. And then opposite him, we have Buyer Betty.
Okay.
Getty is this hyper-competent, ruthless managing director at a rival broker-dealer. She trades with Frank all the time, which means she's constantly having to wield the UPC rulebook like a weapon just to force Frank to clean up his messes.
Right.
And finally, we have customer Carl. Carl is a massive institutional client. He's a whale. He brings in a ton of revenue, but he triggers all sorts of chaotic exceptions because he expects the market to basically just bend to his specific demands.
That's a great cast. So if Betty and Frank are about to execute a trade, the absolute first thing we have to establish is whether they are actually operating inside the UPC sandbox.
Yeah.
Because the Uniform Practice Code does not apply to every single transaction in the market.
Right. And this is something the exam loves to test. The UPC is the street side rule book. It governs over-the-counter, secondary market, broker-to-broker transactions,
Yeah.
meaning it dictates how Frank talks to Betty.
Yeah. And the critical distinction there is broker to broker.
Okay.
If Frank is executing a trade for customer Carl and he sends Carl a trade confirmation, that communication is completely outside the UPC. Customer-facing interactions are governed by a totally separate set of customer confirmation and disclosure rules. The UPC is purely the plumbing between the member firms.
It's member to member. But even then, not all securities get to play in this sandbox, right? Like U.S. Treasuries, for example, they're exempted securities. They have their own massive, highly liquid government ecosystem with its own conventions.
Correct. And municipal securities are another huge exclusion.
Oh, really?
Yeah, munis are incredibly fragmented. You have like tens of thousands of different local issuers, different tax structures, different trading realities. So they are governed entirely by the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board, the MSRB rulebook. They have their own sandbox.
Okay, what about mutual funds and direct participation programs?
Well, mutual funds are generally excluded unless you're dealing with a secondary market trade, like an ETF. And direct participation programs, or DPPs, think, you know, unlisted real estate partnerships or oil and gas limited partnerships, those are highly illiquid. You can't really apply standard two-day or one-day settlement rules to a complex partnership transfer that requires like a general partner's signature. The mechanics just break down.
Okay, so let's say Frank and Betty are trading a standard OTC corporate equity. They are firmly in the UPC sandbox. They agree on a price over the phone. But in the modern market, they don't actually settle this trade bilaterally, do they? FINRA essentially forces them to use a middleman.
They do, yeah. For the vast majority of OTC equity and corporate debt, member firms have to clear and settle their trades through a registered clearing agency that utilizes continuous net settlement, or CNS.
Okay, CNS.
And in the U.S., that is almost always the National Securities Clearing Corporation, the NSCC.
Right. Okay, let's unpack this and talk about the why here. Because if you go back to the 1960s, Wall Street actually had to close down on Wednesdays just to sort through mountains of physical paper certificates, like Broker A owed Broker B, Broker B owed Broker C, and it was this massive tangled web of bilateral risk.
Yeah, the paperwork crisis of the late 60s is exactly why CNS was born. I mean, imagine Failing Frank executes 500 trades today with 100 different rival brokers.
Oh, gosh.
Under a bilateral system, Frank has to physically deliver securities or cash to 100 different counterparties. He carries counterparty risk with all of them, and they all carry risk on him.
Right.
So if Frank goes bankrupt at 3:00 p.m., 100 different firms are suddenly left holding these uncompleted toxic contracts. That is how a single failure cascades into a systemic market collapse.
So CNS steps in to untangle the web. I like to picture this like going out to an expensive dinner with 50 people.
Yep.
If everyone is trying to pay each other back for, you know, shared appetizers and drinks, you're tracking dozens of tiny debts. It's a nightmare. Continuous net settlement is like having one incredibly wealthy friend step in and say, hey, I'm paying the entire restaurant bill. The rest of you just calculate your net total, what you owe minus what you're owed, and you Venmo me that single number.
I love that. That's a brilliant way to conceptualize it. CNS totals up all of Frank's buys and all of his sells for a specific security on a given day, and it nets them down to one single long or short position.
Right.
But the real magic of CNS is novation. The NSCC actually steps into the middle of the trade. It becomes the ultimate buyer to every seller and the ultimate seller to every buyer.
Oh, wow.
So Betty no longer has to worry about Frank going bankrupt because Betty's contract is now guaranteed by the clearing corporation itself.
The central counterparty absorbs the mess. That's huge.
Yeah.
But I want to throw a wrench into this. Okay, listener, think about this for a second. What if Frank and Betty both execute a massive block trade of corporate bonds, but it just so happens that they both clear their trades through the exact same carrying firm, what's called MegaClear LLC. They both use MegaClear to hold their assets and manage their books. Do they still have to route this trade out to the NSCC for a continuous net settlement?
Well, in that specific scenario, no. They qualify for the same carrying member carve-out.
Interesting. Why do they get a pass on using the registered clearing agency?
Because the risk is entirely contained within one house. If Frank and Betty both custody at MegaClear, there is no street-side risk to net out. MegaClear doesn't need to send the trade out into the public plumbing. They just go into their internal ledger, subtract the bonds from Frank's account, and add them to Betty's account.
Oh, I see.
The carrying firm just absorbs the mechanics internally.
It's just an internal journal entry. Keep it in the family, you skip the CNS requirement. Okay, let's move to the actual verification of the trade. Frank and Betty yell at each other over the phone, agree to trade 10,000 shares of some obscure tech stock at $50, and hang up. They now have to legally lock in what just happened before, you know, memories get fuzzy.
Right, which brings us to the uniform comparison process. The rule is strict here. By the end of the trade date, both parties must send each other a uniform comparison, a formal document detailing the exact terms, the security, the price, the quantity, the settlement date.
And I really want to emphasize a super important aspect of that rule. It is a mutual obligation. Frank can't just sit back in his office, put his feet on the desk, and wait for Betty to send her paperwork so he could just nod and agree. he is required to generate and send his own independent comparison.
Exactly. It's a double entry matching system. The entire point is blind verification.
Right.
If Frank thinks he sold the shares at $50 and Betty thinks she bought them at $45, sending independent comparisons is how the system flags the discrepancy immediately.
So what happens when that discrepancy hits? Frank's paper says 50, Betty says 45. Does this instantly escalate to some FINRA arbitration panel?
No, not for a simple discrepancy. If both comparisons arrive on time, but the terms just don't match, the firms investigate. If Frank realizes his trader simply misheard Betty on the phone, Frank is the party in error. He simply generates and sends a corrected comparison to match Betty's terms. It's really just an administrative fix.
But we are dealing with failing Frank here.
Right.
What if Frank just ghosts Betty? Like, Betty sends her comparison by the end of the trade date, and she gets absolutely nothing back from Frank. No confirmation, no corrected comparison, nothing. Betty is sitting there exposed on a 10,000-share trade, and Frank has gone completely dark.
Yeah, Betty cannot let that stand. Market exposure grows by the hour, so Betty initiates a formal DK notice. DK stands for don't know.
A DK notice. Here's where it gets really interesting, because I always thought this sounded like a mafia threat. Like, I don't know you, and I don't know this trade.
I mean, it is essentially a legal ultimatum. A DK notice is used when a firm receives a comparison for a trade it doesn't recognize, or, in Betty's case, when she sends her comparison and gets total silence from the contraparty. Betty issues the DK notice to Frank. She is putting him on the clock. She's basically saying, acknowledge this trade immediately, or I am legally walking away from it.
And this is where the exam loves to test the timeline. When Betty drops that DK notice on Frank's desk, how long does he have to respond?
He has exactly one business day after receiving the DK notice to respond.
Wow, just one day. Yep.
He must either confirm the trade or he must DK it himself, meaning he officially rejects it.
And if Frank just ignores the DK notice?
In the UPC sandbox, silence equals rejection. If that one business day expires with no response, the trade is officially DK'd. It is dead. Betty is released from the contract with zero liability.
One business day. It is ruthless, but I guess it has to be to prevent massive risk buildup. Okay, so let's say they actually get their act together. The comparisons match. They both agree. Frank sold Betty 10,000 shares at $50. Now, the problem is, it's a massive position. And over the next 24 hours before the trade actually settles, the tech company announces a massive accounting fraud. The stock price plummets from $50 down to $20.
Oh, boy. Now Betty is sweating. She is contractually bound to pay Frank $50 a share for a stock that is currently worth $20.
Right.
But she's also terrified because Frank is looking at a massive windfall, and Frank's firm is famously unstable. Betty is worried that Frank might go under before settlement, or that he might just walk away from this uncompleted contract to avoid delivering.
Wait. If the stock dropped, isn't Frank the one making money? Why would he walk away?
Oh, let's reverse the scenario. Let's say Frank sold the stock short to Betty at $50 and the stock rallies to $80.
Got it.
Frank is bleeding cash. Frank owes Betty shares that now cost $80 to acquire, but Betty is only going to pay him $50. That's a $30 per share loss for Frank. Betty knows Frank doesn't have that kind of capital. She is terrified he will just default on the trade.
Okay, that makes perfect sense. So Betty is exposed to Frank's inability to absorb market movement before settlement. How does she mathematically protect herself while the clock is ticking?
She leverages a mechanism called the intermember mark to the market.
Let's break down the mechanics of that. What does Betty actually do?
Betty demands a cash deposit from Frank equal to the adverse price movement. If the contract price is $50 and the market price is now $80, Frank is $30 underwater per share. Betty demands that $30 per share as collateral right now.
Where does that money go? Does Frank just wire it into Betty's personal checking account or what?
Don't know. He can deposit it directly with Betty's firm, or he can put it with a third-party depository or a Federal Reserve member bank. The key is that the collateral is locked up to secure the uncompleted contract.
Okay.
And this mark is dynamic. It's updated periodically, usually daily. If the stock rips to $90 tomorrow, Betty demands another $10 per share. If the stock drops back down to $60, Betty has to release some of that collateral back to Frank.
Now, as you're studying for this Series 24, you're obviously already Series 7 licensed. You have been tested endlessly on margin accounts. When I hear deposit cash to cover an adverse market move, my brain immediately screams margin call.
Oh, sure.
But an intermember mark to the market is not a margin call.
Yeah.
We need to clearly separate these two concepts because the exam will absolutely try to confuse you with them.
Yeah, it's a classic trap. They sound mechanically identical, but they deal with entirely different relationships. The intermember mark to the market is strictly member to member. It is street side. It protects Betty against Frank's failure on an uncompleted contract.
Right.
Customer margin maintenance, which you learn for the Series 7, protects the firm against the customer. It protects Frank against customer Carl when Carl's leveraged portfolio drops in value.
So, directly comparing them. If customer Carl buys $100,000 of stock on margin through Frank, and the portfolio drops to $60,000, Frank issues a margin call to Carl. That's Regulation T in Fund NR margin rules. But if Frank buys stock from Betty, and the stock tanks before settlement, Betty issues a mark to the market demand to Frank. That is UPC.
Exactly. They run in parallel universes. Frank could theoretically be executing a mark-to-market demand against a rival broker in the morning and issuing a margin call to customer Carl in the afternoon.
Poor Frank is just fighting a two-front war. Okay, we keep talking about this window between trade execution and settlement. Let's talk about the ticking clock itself. How long does Frank actually have to deliver these securities?
The regulatory standard for regular way settlement of equities and corporate bonds is now T+1, the first business day following the trade date.
This is a relatively recent shift, right? We spent years at T+2 and before that T+3.
Yeah, we transitioned to T+1 in May of 2024. And the entire rationale for compressing that timeline is exactly what we were just discussing with the mark-to-market.
Counterparty risk.
Exactly. The longer the window between the trade and the settlement, the more time there is for the market to move, for a black swan event to occur, or for a counterparty to go bankrupt. Shortening the window mathematically removes massive amounts of systemic risk from the clearing system.
Okay, so regular way is T+1. That's the default. What are the other delivery types under the UPC?
You have a cash trade. This is an expedited transaction that requires delivery and payment on the exact same day the trade is executed. It's rare, but used when someone needs a position settled immediately for tax or margin reasons.
Got it.
Then you have a seller's option.
How does a seller's option work?
It's a customized contract. The delivery expires on a specific agreed upon future date, say T+10. Right. However, it gives the seller flexibility. The seller can choose to deliver the securities early, anytime after standard T+1, as long as they provide the buyer with prior written notice.
Okay, so regular way is T+1. But this is fine and raw, which means there are always exemptions. We know government securities have always cleared next day, so T+1 isn't new for them. But what is the major exam testable carve out that delays settlement?
The big one you must memorize. Firm commitment syndicate offerings priced after 4:30 p.m. Eastern time. These default to a T+2 settlement cycle.
But why? I mean, if the SEC and FINRA just moved heaven and earth to force the entire market to T+1 to reduce risk, why do these specific IPOs and secondary offerings get an extra 24 hours?
Because you cannot defy the laws of operational physics.
Fair enough.
Think about what actually happens on a syndicate desk. Yeah. Company is going public. The underwriters are battling with the issuer over the final price. They finally agree and price the deal at 5:00 p.m. The syndicate desk now has to mathematically allocate millions of shares across hundreds of different institutional accounts.
Well,
they have to generate the confirmations, ensure prospectus delivery compliance, and get the entire massive block of new shares set up and eligible in the depository trust company, the DTC, system.
It's a logistical mountain of paperwork.
Exactly. You simply cannot process all of that manually and technologically overnight to settle the very next morning. It is impossible. So to prevent massive guaranteed settlement failures on new issues, offerings priced after 4:30 p.m. ET are granted T+2.
That logic completely tracks. Now, to make the standard T+1 work for regular trades, the post-trade processing has to be flawless. Which brings us to the same day affirmation rule.
Right. If a trade is going to settle tomorrow morning, you cannot wait until tomorrow morning to confirm the details. The rule dictates that allocation, confirmation, and affirmation of the trade must happen by the end of the trade date.
Let's bring customer Carl back into the mix.
Right.
Carl's is a massive institutional hedge fund manager. He doesn't custody his billions of dollars with failing Frank.
Right.
He uses a giant global bank as his custodian. When Carl trades, he uses COD or DVP accounts.
COD is collect on delivery. DVP is delivery versus payment. It's the institutional standard.
Just to make sure we truly understand this conceptually, why does Carl use DVP? What is actually happening?
Well, Carl doesn't want Frank's firm holding his assets. He wants his assets sitting safely in a vault at a massive trust bank.
Right.
So Carl calls Frank just for his trading expertise. Frank executes the trade in the open market. But when it comes time to settle, Frank doesn't deliver the stock to Carl. Frank delivers the stock to Carl's custody bank, and the custody bank hands Frank the cash. Delivery versus payment.
Okay, listener, think about this scenario. Carl calls Frank and says, "Hey, Frank, buy me 50,000 shares of Microsoft. Put it through my DVP account. Just execute it now, and I'll have my back office guy email you the exact custodian routing numbers and agent details later tonight." Can Frank accept that order and hit the buy button?
Absolutely not. He cannot execute that trade.
Why? I mean, Carl is a whale. Frank wants the commission.
Because pre-acceptance of details is a strict regulatory requirement. Before Frank can even accept a CI or DVP order, he is legally required to obtain the name and address of Carl's agent and Carl's specific account number.
Because if Carl's back office guy forgets to send that email tonight, what happens?
Frank is completely stuck. He bought 50,000 shares of Microsoft, but he has no idea where to route them for settlement.
Oh no.
The custody bank will reject the delivery because they don't have matching instructions. Frank will fail the T+1 settlement, and he'll be stuck holding massive market risk on his own books. So the rule says, get the details first, or don't take the order. Furthermore, Frank must deliver the confirmation to Carl by the end of that same trade date to ensure same-day affirmation.
Beautiful. No details, no trade. Let's move to settlement day itself. What does it actually look like when Frank delivers? Now, obviously, 99.9% of settlement today is digital, right? It's book entry at the DTC.
Right.
But the Series 24 exam still loves to test the physical rules of good delivery, because those rules form the foundation of how clearing works. So let's pretend Frank physically walks a paper certificate over to Betty's office. Betty is a stickler. What are the strict units of delivery she will accept?
Let's start with equities. For stocks, good delivery requires a 100-share round lots. Or, if the trade itself was for an odd lot, the exact contracted odd lot amount.
Why 100 share lots? Like, why is that the magic number?
It goes back to fungibility and storage. When clearing houses held millions of physical certificates in vaults, they needed standard interchangeable units. If every certificate was a random number of shares, verifying and stacking them would just be a nightmare. So 100 shares became the universal brick of the financial system.
So if Frank owes Betty 500 shares, how can he physically construct that delivery?
He has options as long as they multiply out cleanly. He can deliver one single 500-share certificate. He could deliver five individual 100-share certificates. He could even deliver two 200-share certificates and one 100-share certificate, because all of those break down cleanly into 100-share units.
What can he not do?
He cannot deliver 10 50-share certificates.
Oh.
50 is an odd lot. You cannot aggregate odd lots to make a round lot for delivery purposes unless the original trade was specifically for that odd lot.
Yeah.
Betty will reject those 10 50-share certificates instantly.
What about bonds?
Corporate bonds must be delivered in a $1,000 par face amounts or multiples of $1,000 up to a maximum of $100,000 per certificate.
And unit investment trusts, UITs?
They are delivered in single units of the trust.
Okay, so Frank brought the right denomination. He has a 100-share certificate,
yeah,
but it's a registered security, which means it has someone's name printed on the front. To transfer it to Betty, there has to be an assignment, a signature on the back, signing it over.
And the rule for assignments is absolute exactness. The signature on the back must perfectly match the name registered on the front.
Are there any exceptions to perfectly?
Only two very specific testable exceptions. The ampersand symbol and the word and are interchangeable, and the abbreviation co and the word company are interchangeable.
So if it's registered to Frank Smith Jr., he can't just sign Frank Smith.
No. The junior must be in the signature. A middle initial must be in the signature. If it doesn't match, it is not good delivery. Furthermore, that signature must be authenticated with a medallion signature guarantee from a participating bank or broker dealer.
Let's say Frank brings a certificate. The unit is right, the signature matches, but he forgot to get the medallion stamp. Betty obviously rejects it. My question is about the cost of fixing it. Frank has to hire a courier, send it to a bank, pay for the medallion stamp processing, and courier it back. Does Betty have to split that operational cost because she's the counterparty?
Not a single cent. The UPC is very clear. The expense for failure to comply with good delivery standards falls entirely on the failing party. Frank pays for his own incompetence. Betty just sits back and waits for a legally valid delivery.
I love Betty. Now let's paint a truly absurd scenario. Frank finally gets the medallion stamp. He's walking back to Betty's office, but he drops the certificate in a puddle and a stray dog bites the corner off. The paper is waterlogged and chewed. It is a mutilated certificate. He hands this soggy mess to Betty.
I know it sounds crazy, but mutilated certificates happen. Fire, flood, accidental shredding. When physical certificates were dominant, this was a daily crisis.
So can Betty accept it?
A mutilated certificate is absolutely not good delivery on its own. Betty will reject it. However, it can become good delivery if it is formally authenticated.
Authenticated by who? Who looks at a chewed up piece of paper and restores its legal power?
It must be authenticated by one of four specific entities. The trustee, the registrar, the transfer agent, or the issuer themselves. If one of those four parties examines the serial number and the remnants of the paper and officially stamps it as authentic, then Betty must accept it as good delivery.
Good to know. Okay, one more scenario on good delivery. This is perhaps the most famous exam trap on the Series 24, the deceased owner rule.
Ah, yes.
Frank walks into Betty's office. He has a pristine certificate for 100 shares. It is registered to a man named John Smith. On the back, it is signed by John Smith, and it has a fresh medallion guarantee.
On paper, it looks flawless.
Except for one detail. John Smith died 2 weeks ago. The signature on the back was actually executed by John's son, who is the court-appointed legal executor of John's estate. The son signed his dad's name, the bank stamped it, and Frank is trying to deliver it. What does Betty do?
Betty rejects it instantly.
But why? The son has the legal authority. He's the executor.
Because the law freezes assets upon death. A certificate registered in the name of a deceased person is never good delivery. Hard stop. It does not matter who signed it or what legal documents they hold.
So how does the son actually sell his dad's stock?
The son, acting as the executor, must take that original certificate and send it to the transfer agent along with the death certificate and his court appointment papers.
Okay.
The transfer agent will cancel the dead man's certificate and issue a brand new certificate registered to the estate. It will read something like, John's son, executor for the estate of John Smith. Now, the son can sign his own name on the back of this new certificate, get that guaranteed, and then Frank can deliver it to Betty.
So the legal title has to match the living entity.
Exactly. There is one incredibly narrow exception. If the security was already registered as a fiduciary domestic security, meaning John Smith had already put it into a trust, and the certificate says the John Smith Revocable Trust, then the successor trustee might be able to deliver it without re-registering because the trust didn't die, the person did. But if it's in an individual's name, dead guys do not make good delivery.
Dead guys don't make good delivery. Put that on a flashcard. Let's pivot to bond quirks. Equities are relatively straightforward, but corporate bonds are messy because they are constantly dripping accrued interest and they have complex distribution dates.
Right. When Betty buys a corporate bond from Frank, she isn't just paying for the bond's principal value. She is buying the bond between its semi-annual coupon payments. The next time the company pays interest, Betty is going to receive the full six-month check. But Frank owned the bond for three of those months.
Right.
So Betty has to compensate Frank out of her own pocket for the interest he earned while he held it.
That makes sense. But calculating that requires knowing exactly how many days he held it. How do we count days in bond math?
For corporate bonds governed by the UPC, we use the 3360 day count convention, meaning for the sake of the math, every single month has exactly 30 days, and every year has exactly 360 days.
Wait, including February?
Even February. If a trade settles on February 28th, and another on February 30th, which doesn't exist in reality, but exists in bond math, you calculate based on an artificial 30-day month.
Why did the financial system invent a fake calendar?
Because before computers, syndicate desks had to calculate accrued interest by hand on pieces of paper for thousands of clients. A 360-day year means a bond paying $60 a year accrues exactly $5 a month, or roughly 16.6 cents a day. It made the mental math possible.
Oh, wow.
Now contrast that with U.S. government securities. The government market is massive and historically had better infrastructure, so treasuries use actual, meaning they count the literal actual calendar days.
That is a massive distinction. Corporate bonds, 3360. Government bonds, actual. Now, up to what exact date does this interest accrue? When does the meter stop running for Frank?
Accrued interest is added up to, but not including, the settlement date.
Walk me through the logic of not including.
Ownership officially transfers on the morning of the settlement date. Therefore, the interest generated on that specific day rightfully belongs to the new owner, Betty. So Frank gets paid accrued interest for every single day he owned the bond, right up to midnight the day before settlement.
What if it's a cash trade? We talked about those earlier trades that settle on the exact same day they are executed.
In a cash trade, the trade date is the settlement date. So the accrued interest stops the day before the trade date.
Okay, let's talk about distributions that get messy. Let's say Frank sells a stock to Betty. Betty buys the stock before the ex-dividend date, meaning she bought it in time. She's the rightful legal owner of the upcoming dividend.
Correct. The dividend belongs to Betty.
But Frank is slow. He takes his time delivering the shares, or the paperwork gets jammed up. The official record date passes. The corporation looks at its ledger, sees Frank's name is still technically holding the shares, and they mail the dividend check directly to Frank. Frank now has Betty's money. How does Betty force him to hand it over?
Frank is obligated to issue Betty a due bill.
What mechanically is due bill?
It is a formal, written IOU from the seller to the buyer. It legally acknowledges, I received a distribution that rightfully belongs to you based on our trade date, and I am obligated to remit it to you.
Okay, but we need to split hairs here because the exam terminology is tricky. There is a difference between a due bill and a due bill check. How do I tell them apart?
It depends entirely on the type of asset that was distributed. If the corporation issued a stock dividend, say 10% extra shares, or if they issued stock rights, Frank gives Betty a due bill. It's an IOU for those securities, which he will deliver once he receives them.
And a due bill check.
If the distribution was cash, a cash dividend, or a cash interest payment on a bond, Frank issues a due bill check. This is literally a post-dated check written out to Betty. It is dated to become payable on the exact day the corporation pays out the dividend. It's an automated payment mechanism, so Betty doesn't have to chase Frank down for the cash weeks later.
Due bill equals stock or rights. Due bill check equals cash. Got it.
Yeah.
Now, can Betty sell that due bill? Like, if she holds an IOU from Frank for 50 shares, can she sell that IOU to customer Carl?
Absolutely not. A due bill is neither transferable nor assignable. It is a bilateral obligation between Frank and Betty. She just has to wait for Frank to deliver.
One final bond-related question, transfer fees. When a security changes hands and needs to be re-registered in a new name, the transfer agent charges a fee. Who pays it, the buyer or the seller?
People overcomplicate this, but the UPC rule is elegantly simple. The fee is paid by the party at whose instance the transfer is made.
At whose instance, meaning whoever asked for it?
Exactly. Let's say Betty buys a bond from Frank. Frank delivers it in perfectly good form. It's registered in Frank's firm's name, endorsed correctly. It is good delivery. But Betty says, I don't want to hold this in street name. I want this physically re-registered into my personal name to put in my vault. Betty is requesting a transfer solely for her own preference. Betty pays the fee.
But what if Frank shows up with a certificate registered to his random uncle? Betty says, this is not good delivery. I reject it. You need to transfer this into your firm's name first.
In that case, Frank is forced to request the transfer in order to make the security deliverable. Because Frank requested it to fix his own delivery issue, Frank pays the fee. It's not automatically the buyer or the seller. It's the party whose action necessitated the transfer.
Let's move to the final phase. We are past the settlement date. Frank has officially failed. He didn't deliver the stock. He didn't deliver the bonds. He is in default. Betty is done playing nice. She has issued the DK notices. She has demanded mark-to-market collateral. But she needs to close this contract out. What is her ultimate nuclear option?
Betty triggers a buy-in.
Walk me through the mechanics of a buy-in. Betty is the buyer. Frank is the failing seller.
Yeah.
What is her first move?
She cannot just execute it immediately. Betty must issue a formal written notice of intent to Frank. The notice must be delivered no later than 12 p.m. Eastern time, at least 2 business days before she plans to execute the buy-in.
Wait, why give him 2 days? He already failed. Why not just go to the open market and buy the stock instantly?
Because forcing a buy-in creates massive market friction and potential losses. The 2-day window is a final grace period. It gives Frank 48 hours to frantically call his stock loan desk to borrow the shares or to pressure whoever is failing to deliver to him. It's a cooling off period to see if the natural settlement process can resolve itself.
Okay, but let's say 2 days pass. Frank still has nothing. Betty goes into the open market. The stock they originally contracted at $50 is now trading at $75. Betty buys the shares at $75 to satisfy her own accounts. Who absorbs that $25 per share loss?
Frank does. The rule dictates that a buy-in is executed at the defaulting seller's risk and cost. Betty sends Frank a bill for the price difference, plus any brokerage commissions she incurred to execute the trade. Frank pays for his failure.
Okay, let's flip the script. Let's imagine a world where Frank actually has his act together.
Hard to imagine, but okay.
Right, so Frank has the shares. On T+1, he attempts to deliver them to Betty. But Betty's back office systems are completely offline. She has a localized tech outage, and she fails to accept the delivery. Frank is standing there holding the securities. What is Frank's nuclear option?
Frank triggers a sellout.
He sells the shares he was trying to give her.
Yes. He is closing out the failing buyer. He takes the shares into the best available open market, sells them, and if he gets a price lower than their original contract price, Betty owes him the difference.
Now, what is the notice period for Frank? Does he have to give Betty 2 business days notice at 12 p.m. ET?
This is a huge exam point. There is NYO advance notice required for a sellout.
Wait, why is there such a massive asymmetry? Betty the buyer has to wait 2 whole days to execute a buy-in, but Frank the seller can execute a sellout with 0 advance notice.
It comes down to the physical burden of the asset. Think about Betty's position in a buy-in. She wants something Frank doesn't have. It takes time for Frank to scour the market and find those shares, hence the 2-day grace period.
Oh, I see.
But look at Frank's position in a sellout. He already has the shares in his hands. He is holding a depreciating inventory that he doesn't want and shouldn't have to carry on his books. He has market risk by the minute. He has no other remedy to protect his capital than to dump those shares immediately. The rules grant him immediate recourse.
What's fascinating here is that it makes total logical sense when you look at who is holding the risk.
Yep.
So Frank dumps them immediately without telling her. Does he ever have to notify Betty?
Yes. Once the sellout is executed, Frank must notify Betty by 6 p.m. ET on that exact same day, detailing the price he got and what she owes him.
Buy-in. 2 days notice by noon. Sellout. 0 advance notice. Notify by 6 p.m. Okay, now what if Betty did accept the delivery from Frank? The trade settled. But 2 weeks later, Betty's vault audits the certificate and realizes it has a massive defect. Maybe it's a foreign security with a currency restriction they didn't notice. Betty wants to return it to Frank and demand her money back.
This process is called a reclamation. It is the legal right to return improperly delivered securities after settlement has already occurred. And the UPC defines very strict time windows for reclamation based on the severity of the defect.
Let's go through the windows.
If it's a minor irregularity, like a slight currency mismatch or a minor signature issue that slipped through, Betty has 15 days from the date of delivery to reclaim it.
Okay.
If the defect involves a foreign security, the window expands to 45 days because cross-border verification just takes longer.
What is the most extreme window? Like, what if Betty discovers the certificate Frank handed her was literally stolen property from another bank?
If a security is discovered to be lost, stolen, or confiscated, the reclamation window is an astonishing 30 months.
2.5 years. Why does she get 30 months?
Uh-huh.
Everything else in this rule book is measured in hours or single days.
It has to do with the latency of physical theft. If a criminal steals a bearer bond or a blank certificate from a vault, they don't immediately inform the transfer agent. They sell it to a shady broker who sells it to a market maker who sells it to Frank who delivers it to Betty.
Right.
Betty puts it in her vault and forgets about it. A year later, Betty finally tries to sell it or transfer the registration. That is the exact moment the transfer agent finally runs the serial number and flags it as stolen. The 30-month window is designed to protect the innocent downstream buyer by covering that massive time gap between the original theft and the eventual discovery.
So Betty issues a reclamation, hands the stolen paper back to Frank, and Frank has to give her the cash back. He can then go reclaim it from whoever sold it to him, cascading back up the chain.
Exactly. But Betty must use a formal uniform reclamation form. If she just throws the certificate in an envelope and mails it back to Frank with a sticky note, Frank can treat it as an improper delivery on her part, and he can immediately sell her out within 3 business days.
Forms on forms. Okay, one final card out on closeouts. What if the securities failing to deliver are rights or warrants? These are derivatives. They have strict expiration dates. If Betty has to give Frank a 2-day notice for a buy-in, those warrants might literally expire worthless while she's waiting.
The UPC recognizes that time decay risk. Closeouts for expiring rights and warrants are granted a special exemption. They must be timed to occur before expiration. Betty is allowed to bypass the standard 2-day buy-in notice. She can issue a specialized liability notice, or in extreme cases, she can execute a no-notice buy-in on the exact expiration date to ensure she captures the intrinsic value before the derivative evaporates into nothing.
Because if they expire, the value goes to 0 and the system fails. All right, we have covered a massive amount of operational plumbing today. Let's pull this all together. Give me 5 rapid-fire core takeaways that a Series 24 candidate can take into the exam room. Not just facts, but the mechanics behind them.
Number 1, the intermember mark to the market protects member-to-member risk on uncompleted contracts, completely separate from customer margin rules. Number 2, Corporate bonds use a 3,360-day count to simplify math, and accrued interest stops the day before settlement because the buyer owns the interest on settlement day.
Perfect. Number three.
Number three. DK notices, don't know notices, give the contraparty exactly one business day to respond because unconfirmed trades build exponential market risk.
Number four.
Number four. Buy-ins require a two-day notice to allow the seller to source the asset. Sellouts require zero advance notice because the seller is trapped holding depreciating inventory. It's all about the burden of the asset.
And number five.
Number five. A certificate signed by a deceased person is never good delivery because assets are legally frozen upon death until re-registered by a fiduciary.
Dead guys don't deliver.
Okay.
Okay, as we wrap up this deep dive, I always like to leave you with something to chew on, a broader perspective that pushes beyond the textbook. We spent this entire time talking about the ticking clock of T+1, the two-day grace periods for buy-ins, the one-day window for DK notices. It's all based on time.
And time is compressing. The industry moved from T+3 to T+2 and now to T+1 entirely to squeeze counterparty risk out of the system. But if you look at the horizon, with the rise of distributed ledgers, blockchain technology, and atomic settlement, we are staring directly down the barrel of T+0, instantaneous, real-time settlement.
Literally swapping the asset for cash in the same millisecond.
Exactly. But think about the cascading implications of that. If settlement becomes truly instantaneous, this entire UPC architecture we just dissected might completely collapse. A DK notice gives you a day to figure out a discrepancy. A buy-in gives you 2 days to find the shares. That entire safety net exists because there is a gap between trade and settlement.
Right.
If that gap shrinks to zero, there's no time for a mark to market. There is no time to fix a mismatched comparison. Every mistake becomes permanent instantly. So the provocative question for the industry is, are human broker dealers, with their messy back offices and their failing franks, actually prepared to survive in a world where there is exactly zero time to fix a mistake?
From the murky waters of two-day delays straight into a high-speed collision where you literally cannot hit the brakes. That is a wild thought to leave on. If you're studying for the 24, take the logic of these rules. Understand why they exist. Go into that testing center and absolutely crush it. Keep diving deep.